Good afternoon, gentlemen. We're going to conclude our review of Spring 2019 Contemporary Halacha. We're going to go over the Hilchas Shechita from Shachter, Rabbi Simon's Dateline, Datari Reichman's Brain Death Shir, and Rabbi Sobolovsky's Mikvah Shir, and then we might finish off with Mechiras Chametz that I gave, if we have time. So let's begin with Rabbi Shachter's Shir on Hilchas Shechita. So the first point in the shir is the question whether shechita in general, of course, shechita's kachim is a mitzvah, but shechita's chulin, a mitzvah, or only a matir. So the Rambam Sefer Mitzvah seems to say that it's a mitzvah to shecht. However, the Ravid's Hasaga says that it's not an asay to shecht, it's at best a laf haba mechlala say to not eat nevela. So this might shed light on another question. We know that there's a shaila if Shechita only requires rov of two simanim, but is it lechatchila to do all of the simanim? So the fact that the Rambam is machmir says that lechatchila you should do kulo, perhaps that's indicative of his shita that holds that shechita is a mitzvah. Since you hold that it's a mitzvah, therefore you could say there's an inyan of being lechatchila. However, if something would only be a matir, there's no concept of a lechatchila or a bidyeva dekamatir. It's either matir or not matir. So therefore, if you would hold that it's a matir, then there would be no room to say that there's a lechatchila din to shecht, not just rov of the simanim, but kulo. So this is why it might be that the rabbi l'shita say he holds that it's a mitzvah, and therefore he could hold that there is a lechatchila to shecht, not only rov, but kulo also. That's the first point. The other nekuda that comes out is the question of making a bracha on shechita. Is the very fact that you make a bracha a proof that it's a mitzvah? So perhaps we could say no, even if you hold that it's only a matir, you could still have a bracha on a matir, just like we see by Erech Hatzeros, which is only a matir, and nevertheless you can recite a bracha. But let's talk about it, now let's talk about the next point, which is making a bracha in general. So you make a bracha on shechita, but what happens if you know that it's a treifa? If you know that it's a treifa, so then we have a machlokas rishonim if you would make a bracha on such a shechita. Rav Rishonim say you do not make a bracha. Rash says you do make a bracha because even though you're not being machshir this animal to eat because it's still going to be a treifa, so even if you do a good shechita, it's still a treifa. But you are taking off the tumas nevela because a treifa doesn't have tuma, only a nevela does. And therefore you can make a bracha on that removal of tumas nevela that would occur if you shechted a treifa. Now, that's all true if it's just a treifa. What happens if it's not a treifa, it's an afula? Meaning, it fell down a flight of stairs, and maybe a treifa may not be a treifa. And you're only going to know after you shechted and you check it, so then could you make a bracha? So, of course, beforehand, you can't make a bracha, because it might indeed be a treifa. But after you find, you shechted it, and you find the taka wasn't a treifa, could you recite a bracha then? So, remarkably enough, the Rama says that you can recite a bracha on a shechitas treifa after the shechita. And there's a long shach who asks, what do you mean? But you already did the mitzvah. So, nevertheless, the Rambam says, and based on the Rambam who says, the mashan nasa kvar nasa, you can recite a bracha after you did the shechita. However, Rashi, who mentioned earlier, who says you could make a bracha in general on a treifa, well, certainly on a fula he'll allow. And furthermore, the Rama says you can recite a bracha afterwards if it's a nefula. Does the fact that the Rama's make by nefula show that you could always say a bracha after the mitzvah? It could be that since here there's no other option, it's similar to birchas tvila of a ger after the mikvah, where the Gemara also says there's no other option but to make the bracha afterwards. So just like a ger could only recite the bracha asher kedishanu after his tovel, so to here, Chazal might have established that by nefula, where you could only recite a bracha after your shochet, so then you would be permitted to do so. Masha Einkin, if a person did stav mitzvah, for example, did a kedushin and forgot to recite birchas erusin, maybe in such a case where you could have done it before you just forgot, there Chazal never established this bracha, or never masakin a bracha at all. And only in these cases where the only way to do it is after the mitzvah, like by Tfilas Ker and by Nefula, only there perhaps would the Ramah permit you to recite a bracha afterwards. The next point in the shir was the shechita of a nachri. We know the Mishnah tells us that a nachri's shechita does not work. The question is why. So we have a fundamental machlokas rishonim. Tosa says because shechita is not shayach to a guy. You need to have a bar zvicha, someone for whom shechita is nogea. And a guy is not shy to either of the aspects of Nevela. He's not chayiv in the Isser of Yachilis Nevela, nor is he mitzuva in the Nyanim of Tumah that Nevela carries with it, so Shechita doesn't relate to him. The Ram has a different opinion. The Ram says that since a Stam Machsheves guy is for Avodah Zarah, we're worried that his Shechita might have an intent of Avodah Zarah. So even though it might not make it Asr Behana, there is an opinion who holds that a Machsheves Shechita's Akam would be Asr Behana. We don't hold that much. We hold at least that it would be Asr Behachila because of the potential Machsheva that a guy might have for Avodah Zarah. Now, is this Dereis? Is this Derabanan? So, meaning if a guy shechts, is it possible? So this is a question because there's a lashon that sounds like geder gadol gidru, that sounds like it might be a derabanan. But Reb Chaim thought that if a guy would shecht, it would be aser mid araisa. Now, what would be enough nafkamina between the Rambam and Tosfos? So Rav Yosef Engel suggests the following situation: let's say you have a Jew and a guy shecht together. Both have hands, excuse me, on Baruch Atah Adonai, Melech HaOlam Shehakol Nehyeh Bedvaro. Sorry. Both are cutting with the knife and providing the Shechita. So if you hold that, like the Rambam, that there might be a negative kavana, so that will ruin it, even if the Yisrael is present. Masha'inkin, according to Tosfos, that you just the Shechitas Akam doesn't provide for me he's not a bar zvicha, but here you have Yisrael who's doing a zvicha also, so he'll provide whatever the bar zvicha that's necessary. In halach lemais, the Shulchan Aruch Aser is such a case where both are doing it simultaneously. So it sounds as though the Shulchan Aruch is holding, like the Rambam, that that there is a problem, that there is a negative aspect of the guy's participation because he might have bad kavanas of Avodah Zarah. Next point would be, what about the Shechita of a Katan? Because we know that when it comes to the psukim between that relate to Tefillin and Mezuzah, that a bar kshiras tefillin is a bar ksivas mezuzah, and since a katan is not a chiyav in tefillin, he also can't write a mezuzah. So according to that logic, should we say the same thing? That a katan should not be allowed, since a katan is not a bar zvicha because he is allowed it katan achal nevelos, so too he should be asur deshecht? Should we say the same kind of logic like that? So we answer that no. Even though a katan is not a bar zvicha, similar to a guy in the sad fact that he's allowed to eat nevela, but regarding Tumah, even though he's a Katan, he is in the parish of Tumah. And therefore, a Yisrael Katan can become Tameh, and it is the Sugi of Tumah. And therefore, he is a Bar Zvicha regarding the additional Tumas, din of Tumas Nevela. And therefore, maybe a Shechitas Katan would be better than a Shechitas Gai. Next point would be, what about a Mumar? Well, Mumar, we know, is Dino Ka'akam, and also would not be Kasher. The question is, how much of a Mumar? Presumably, remover the rov dinei Torah. But there are some averus that even if you remove it just for one thing, like Avodah Zarah and Shabbos, that also would be dino ka'akom. Is this a psul d'oraisa d'rabbanan? The Chida suggests that maybe it's machlokas rishonim, but we know that even if a goy could provide could bring a korban, so let's not get into that now. Okay, next point is, what about a kusi sheshachat? Here we know the kusim, question whether the kusim were geri emes later in history or geri arayas, even though the original one was not proper, but perhaps later in history did become geri emes. So that's a question how we look at them. If we assume that they are geri emes, it could be that the shechita would work theoretically, but you would still need a gadol amid al gama because they're still nechshon lefne iver. The Chazanish asks a question on this, in this situation, but wait a second. We know that the Kusim didn't accept certain parts of Torah. And we know that by Stam Yenam, if there's an Apikoros who doesn't believe that Torah Shabbal Peh is Min HaShemayim, so it's considered Stam Yenam. So how can Shechita will be okay? So Chazon Ish has two answers. Number one, that the original Kusim rejected Torah Min HaShemayim. But the young ones were Kofrim B'Shogeg, and that's not going to mess up what they do. In other words, if they're a kofar b'shogeg, that's not going to passel their shechita. Now, this is against Reb Chaim, because Reb Chaim is famously known to say, Nebuchad not because is Eichad not because, that even if you're, you know, it's not your fault that you're not because, you're still not because. That's one answer. The Chazanish gives another answer, though, that the reason why the shechita of a kusi might work, as long as there's Gadol Amid Al Gaba, is because whatever they did believe, whatever they did practice, they believed in. So as far as this mitzvah of shechita, if they did it, then they believed in it, and that would be okay. That would be sufficient. Okay, let's go to the next point in the shir, and that is, do you need kavana to do a shechita? So by kachm, of course, the pasuk says that tzonchem tizbachuhu, you do. The question is, what about by regular chulin? So here we have a gemara that talks about a situation in Bava Kama where a person has a rock on his lap and he stands up, and the rock falls down and damages. Are you chayiv or not? So the Rashba says, similar to that, if you have a knife on your lap and stand up and it falls down and shechts, that's not considered kach gavra and it's not good. So what do you see from this? You see that you don't really have to have kavana to actually do a shechita. You just have to have kavana to have, you know, swung a knife or done something. So not necessarily to kill an animal, to shecht an animal, to get shnei simanim or rov of shnei simanim. You just had to intend to do something. If you just stood up and a knife fell down, you didn't have any kavana, that wouldn't be enough. So, that's... the way we paskin is that chulin does not need kavana, just like tefillah in a mikvah. She doesn't have to have in mind that she's being tavelas, and nafal v'nar would suffice. Let's talk about the five psulim of shechita. We learn from the pasuk, "Zavachta kasher tzivisicha," that Hashem commanded us certain ways to do zvicha. The Torah says that, but the Torah doesn't tell us what those halachos are. And Chazal and the Torah Shabbat Peh tell us that it's referring to five psulim of shechita, and they are shehiya, which is pausing in the midst of your shechita. Number two is ikur. Ikur is question whether it means that you're using a sake that has a pagam in it, and there's a ripping aspect, or the Bahag who says no, ikur is if the kana and the veshet were detached from the lechi before shechita, which is unrelated to, you know, a pagam. Hagrama, which means that the slice was done in the wrong part of the neck, meaning too high already at the cheek area or too low in the lungs there. It wasn't done in the place of shechita. Hadrasa, which is a chopping action, pushing down, putting downwards pressure without the back and forth motion. And the fifth psul of shechita would be chalada. That would be... sorry. Chalada would be if the knife would be covered over as it's shechting, or covered over by the skin, or covered over by something, covered over by, if the knife is not revealed as it's doing the shechita. So now, let's talk for a moment about shehiyah. What would happen if you do shehiyah? So it's puzzle. Let's say you did the rov of the, what's the reason that she is a problem? Let's assume that, just like you see shehiyah by other mitzvahs, shema, for example, if you pause in the middle, it breaks the first half of the shema from the second half of the shema. They're disconnected if there's too much of a pause in the middle. So if you have a pause in the middle of the shechita, the beginning of your shechita does not correlate to the end of your shechita, and it's not yotzei. It's not going to be a good shechita. However, let's say you shechted rov simanim, and that itself would be sufficient, and you paused before you finished. Now, theoretically, if you'd stop there, it's a good shechita. However, let's say you did finish the shechita there. This is what we call shaha b'miut simanim. Rashi said, this might be a problem. This is a nidbaidul ifshta, which we're machmir for, and it's a problem. Tos says, what do you mean? But you did a full shechita already. So you see an incredible thing that Rashi understands that shehiyah is not just that it's a pause between the first and the second half, because, hey, you did the full shechita already. But rather, shehiyah is a posel. Not just a lack of seer, but it is a real posel. And therefore, it would be better, according to this opinion of Rashi, that if you did Rav Simanim and then you pause, the Shechita was good. You fulfilled the Shechita as kosher animal. It's better to, instead of continuing to Shechita, would be this posel of Shehiyah, rather take a baseball bat and knock it off. At this point, instead of using a baseball bat, would you be allowed to use a sock and paguma? Well, it should depend on what we said a minute ago, what the isra of ikur is. If you hold that ikur is a psul in the shechita, like the bahag, it's a psul in the shechita, then it will be a problem. It will be nevela. Masha Einkein, if you hold that a sock and paguma, I'm sorry, I take that back. Rashi says that shechting with a sock and paguma is ikur, and that would be a problem. It would be a psul in the shechita. But according to the Bahag, sak and paguma is unrelated. It's not nothing to do with the shechita. It's just like ripping the neck apart. That would be the same as a baseball bat, and that would be okay at the latter part after the shehiyah. That would be okay. What happens if you did a hagrama in the shehiyah basra? Meaning after you did the shechita of Rav Simanim, you paused, and then you wanted to do a chopping. So presumably, chopping might not be even called a shechita because it's not in the makom shechita. It's like cutting off an arm. That would probably be okay. Let's now finish off this year with a quick discussion of Kisei Hadam. First of all, Kisei Hadam only applies to ofos and chayos, like deer, but not behema, like cows, sheep, etc. Next, it only applies when it requires ofer milamala as well as ofer milamata. We know that Kisei Hadam, you could do one act of Kisei for many chayos, or for many ofos, but could you do Kisei Hadam, one Kisei Hadam for both chaya and ofos? I think because there's a difference in the halach of the Kisei. I think one needs only milamata, one needs milamata, I don't remember exactly, but we hold that one Kisei Hadam would indeed work for both chayos and ofos at the same time, even though their halachas are a little bit similar. Is the shochet allowed to be mechabed others to do the kisei? The Prima Gadim says, just like by mila, it should be the same as mila. If the father's a mold, could he appoint someone else to do the mila, which the minhag is to be mekel? But by kisei dam, we don't really have, so we don't know what the minhag is. The shach indeed is machmir, and says you can't, it's like mechzis begufi, you can't appoint a shliach. But the minhag seems to be that shochetim do allow other people to do are mechabed others with the kisei hadam. As far as checking the lungs, is the last point. Mi ikar hadin, the Torah follows Rov, and Rov animals don't have sirchus on their lungs, you should not have to do a shechita. However, there's din d'rabbanan, that if there is a miyad hamatzui of concern that could be problematic, then you should do a bedika. So, since there is presumably a miyad hamatzui of animals that have sirchus on the lungs, we do a bedika on the lungs. All the other theoretical possible trefas that may or may not exist are less than a miyad hamatzi. The miyad she'en hamatzi, that's why we don't do bedikas on them, we don't check for them. How much exactly is a miyad hamatzi? So Mishkan Es Yaakov says miyad hamatzi would be 10%, and there are different numbers that are suggested for how often trefas are found in lungs. Okay, that was one shir. Let's now go to the next shir, which is brain death. Rabbi Dr. Reichman's shir on brain death. Here we have to just know a little bit of, we're not really going to get into the history, but you're welcome to look up the history on your own. We have different places. We have to remember that in the late 1700s, there was the takana of the Duke of Mecklenburg, not a Jewish takana, but the government suggests that you shouldn't bury until 3 days after death when there is definite death, and we have a problem. Is that going to be a suffix? Should we entertain the possibility of it being a suffix? Pikach nefesh, suffix, maybe he's alive. On the other hand, we have the Isra of Halon Es Hameh. So Rav Yaakov Emden said no, all the poskim said no, we don't wait 3 days. There's a Mesechus Katanos that say that they once found somebody who, after he was buried, and they checked on him, and they found that he was alive, and he lived for many more years. No, that's a very, an unusual situation. Chasam Sofer also said that you can't delay a burial just because of the governmental sanctions. Okay, so now let's get into the real issue of a brain death. The issue of brain death is the following, that until recently, the stopping of the heart meant that there's going to be stopping of breathing and a person will die. However, we happened in 1968, you have the ability that the a machine, a respirator, or a ventilator could help the body continue to breathe. And even after the brain completely stops functioning, the breathing that the machine does allows oxygen to get to the heart, and the heart will continue to beat even if there's no brain function. So what this means, for the first time in history, with the invention of the respirator, is you could have a person who's brain dead, but his heart will still be beating because we're providing the oxygen that the heart needs to continue to function. So the question is, will this be so? According to the Harvard Medical School, brain death, with whatever criteria, you could look it up if you want to look at the article, will be brain death. Question is, what will we hold is brain death? So obviously there are a lot of nafkaminas as to whether brain death is brain death. First of all, you let it disconnect the person. Are they dead already? Is there a chiyuv kvura, you know, per the moment a person is brain dead or not yet? Is there tumas kohen while a person is sitting on the respirator with their brain being dead? Is a person who's brain dead, his wife allowed to remarry? And perhaps the most acute question is, if a person is brain dead, can you take their organs for transplant? Because they're very, the brain dead person is the ideal transplant donator, because once there is a cardiac death, then there's no blood flow to the organs, and the organs start to decompose very quickly. But if you have a brain dead person, so the brain, if we assume the brain dead is dead, so he's dead, and the heart is still pumping and giving O2 to the, giving oxygen to all the organs. The organs are fresh and healthy, even though the person might be, according to that opinion, considered dead. And therefore, you could schedule a transplant whenever you need to schedule it and be able to save people. So those are the questions at hand. Now let's look at the sources. We have very few sources in Shas. Maybe two sources in Shas that really could shed light on this issue. Number one is the most important source is the Gemara in Yuma, which asks, if you find somebody buried under rubble of a collapsed building on Shabbos, ad heichon hu bodek. And there's a machlokas. The machlokas is ad chotmo, v'yesh omrim ad libo. So, one way to read it would be, the question is he dead or not? Meaning, one way to check is his nose, is he breathing? The other is his heart pumping? That, you might read that this Gemara is telling you, that the Gemara is telling you that the criteria for death, according to one opinion, is breathing, and the other opinion is the heartbeat. In other words, is whether the machlokes is in the Gemara is whether brain death is death. If breathing is the criteria, so once you stop breathing, and there's brain death, then it's dead. The other one says no, the heart has to stop, which would mean that brain dead would still be alive because the heart is still pumping. But that's not really how the Gemara is to be understood, according to some. Because the Gemara continues and says that machlokas is only if you come across the head and then want to go down the body. But if you first stumble upon the person's feet, so then the Gemara says, I'm sorry, that machlokas applies if you stumble upon the person's feet. But if you stumble upon the person's head, you meet him head first under the rubble, then kaven debodekli ad chotmo shuv einsach. Once you check his nose, you don't have to do any more checking. Why not? So Rashi here explains. Rashi explains that the whole machlokas of these two opinions, whether you check heart or mouth, it's not what is the definition of death, but rather what is the simen that he is not breathing. Meaning, according to Rashi, if you checked it from feet first, then you might miss the heartbeat, so you should still go ahead and check for breathing in his nose. Because if he's breathing, then you know that his heart is beating, as the Chacham Tzvi points out. But if you check his nose and there's no breathing, then you know then you don't have to check any further. So according to Rashi, this Gemara is not telling you what the criteria, what defines death. Everyone agrees that it's totally on the heart beating. The question is, how do you measure if there's a heartbeat? Is it enough to just check the heart? Heart's beating? So you know he's alive. Or if you can't tell from the heartbeat, then you could tell by checking his breathing. If he's breathing, then you know there must be a heartbeat as well. So according to this, according to Rashi, it sounds like the Gemara is not telling you whether or not the person we follow breath or heartbeat. Rather, Everyone agrees it's the heartbeat. The question is, how do you figure out if the heartbeat is there? Is it enough to check the heart alone, or do you have to check the heartbeat by evaluating his breathing? The Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch passing that we do follow Chotmo, that you'd, the way Rashi reads is that the way to determine if the heart is beating is by not only checking his heart, by also making sure, by checking if he's breathing. If he's not breathing, then you know that is, if he stopped breathing, then you know that the heart has stopped as well. According to the way we're reading this, according to Rashi, everyone agrees that a heart-beating body is alive, and a brain-dead person is therefore still alive since his heart is beating, and therefore you will not be able to use his organs. Accordingly, brain-dead would not be brain-deaf. That's one source. Another source is a Mishnah in Olos. Mishnah in Olos basically says, is talking about Tumah, and it says that if a person's decapitated, even if they're jumping around, even though they're mefarches, the person will have tumas meis. So there are a number of ways to read this Mishnah that will signify how we look at decapitation. The Rabbanut HaRashit says very simply, if a person's head is cut off, so they're not breathing. If he's not breathing, he's dead. That's how the Rabbanut looks at it. Brain death is death. And therefore, once he's not breathing, once his head is decapitated, he's not breathing, so he's dead. And therefore, there's nothing more to talk about, which is a little bit difficult because there are people who are not able to breathe on their own, and yet they're still alive. All the people who had polio and were in our iron lungs, Christopher Reeve, who played Superman, was on a respirator, you know, was not able to breathe on his own, but he was married and giving lectures. It's hard to say that he's dead and he's Matayim Ba'ohel, even though he's, you know, being wheeled around in his wheelchair and by his wife and lecturing in, you know, giving inspirational speeches. Rabbi Tendler has another way to read this Mishnah. Rabbi Tendler understands this Mishnah to mean that, well, we're not going to go into Rabbi Tendler's opinion. I don't think it was Rabbi Rech who mentioned that. Another opinion is that the Mishnah is telling us that any motion, that any vital motion, any bodily motion, any movement, physiological motion, shows that there's life. And therefore, heartbeat is life. And the Mishnah is telling you that the one exception to that is that the pirchus that occurs, the jumping around, the jumping of the nervous system, after a head is chopped off, that is the only motion that is not life. Meaning the Mishnah is being mechadish to you that when the head is chopped off and the body still moves, that's not life. That's, the person is dead. But any other motion does show that there is a life. According to that, brain death would not be death because even after the brain is dead, there's still a vital motion. The heartbeat is still moving. The heart is still moving. Therefore, there would be life. And therefore, brain death would not be considered brain death. Brain death would not be considered death according to this understanding. That's Rav Bleich, and it's Rav Eliyashu, it's Tzitz Eliezer, Rav Osner. Fine. Rav Schechter has a unique shita that, based on the Gemara, that says that there are shloshet varim shanashama tluya bahen, the heart, the brain, and the liver. And we're misupik whether death means that all three of them are gone, or any one of those three are gone. And therefore, misafek, we have to treat a brain dead person as a safek alive, because maybe maybe you only have one of the three not working, but the heart is still working, and therefore you might not have all shlosha evarim shanashama tluya bahem dysfunction. Therefore, the person might still be alive. That's the end of the shir about brain death. Let's go now to the next shir, which is going to be Rabbi Simon's shir on the international dateline. So to just understand the international dateline, I'll give you an example that I heard in a different shir to clarify just the situation. Let's say you're flying from New York and you want to go to China. So you could go in two ways. You could fly over America, you could fly over LA, over Hawaii, and get to China. China, which is, let's say, 180 degrees behind, you know, opposite side of the world of New York. Now, if you're doing that, every hour that you travel, it gets earlier and earlier. So if you leave here, let's say, at noon today, which is Wednesday at noon, and you go back, 12 hours back, you're going to get there 12 hours before will be, instead of noon on Wednesday, you're going to get there at the beginning, you're going to get there at midnight, Tuesday night, midnight. However, let's say you were traveling from New York in the opposite direction, towards, over the Atlantic, towards Israel, and every hour you travel is later. Later. So when you travel from New York, you'll get to China 12 hours later. It will be midnight, not on Tuesday night, but midnight on Wednesday night. So that means if you had two people leave New York at the same exact time, one traveled towards California, westerly to China, he'll get there on Tuesday night, and the same, his friend who's traveling on a plane in the opposite direction, going to the same place, traveling at the same speed, will get there at the same exact time, except for him it will be 12 o'clock Wednesday night, a different day. So how in the world could that be? So it must be that there is some arbitrary line that just determines what is the time that they're the first people to, the day starts. Where does the day start for the world? We have to just pick an arbitrary line, and at any point in that, on one side of the line, it will be considered Sunday, the next point will be Monday. We just have to pick an arbitrary line. The question is, how do you pick that arbitrary line? Where is that arbitrary line that will determine that this is the first location in the world that where their Shkia brings in Shabbos? And every other zone is going to be later this, until 24 hours later, right before that line, it will be considered the previous day. So now we have a Gemara in Rosh Hashanah. The Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, without getting into the details, talks about the Levana happening before Chatzos. If the Levana happens, the Molad of the Levana happens before Chatzos, then it could be Rosh Chodesh. If the Molad of the Levana happens after Chatzos, then it will not be Rosh Chodesh. Without getting into the details, Rashi understands that this has nothing to do with a dateline. All this has to do is when you, how many hours it takes after the Molad or before the Molad to be Rosh Chodesh. We're not going to get into that. However, the Baal Amor and the Kuzari read this Gemara in Rosh Hashanah Daf Chaf Amud Beis to tell us the halacha of the international dateline. And the way they understand the Gemara is as follows. They understand that the Gemara is telling us that in order for Rosh Chodesh to be on day 30, it has to be that the Molad has to occur before the day began. Meaning before, you want the entirety of day 30 to come after the Molad. If all of day 30 happens after the Molad, meaning the Molad begins, the Molad occurs right sometime before Shkia, then day 30 can count as Rosh Chodesh. However, if the Molad is seen on Rosh Chodesh, on day 30, then it can't be Rosh Chodesh. Now, that which we're saying, that the Molad has to happen before Shkia, in order for all of day 30 to be after the Molad, in order for day 30 to be Rosh Chodesh, that does not have to happen in Yerushalayim. As long as there's one place in the world where the Molad occurs before Shkia, then the 30th day can be Rosh Chodesh. So what's the role of Yerushalayim? So says the Baal Amor, where is the first Shkia in the world and where is Yerushalayim? Says the Baal Amor, Yerushalayim is the sixth time zone of where Shkia is not the first Shkia of the world, but rather the sixth. So that means that there are 6 hours of land. By telling, when the Gemara says that then the Gemara Shana says that the Molad had to be seen before Chatzos, it's telling us that Yerushalayim, that there are 6 hours of land before Yerushalayim. And that means after Yerushalayim, there are 18 hours of land. So if the world is 360 degrees, then 24 hours will get 15 degrees each. So that means if Yerushalayim is the sixth zone of time, then each one is 15 degrees. So 6 times 15 will be 90 degrees. So 90 degrees to the east of Yerushalayim will be the first Shkia of the day. So that means if the Molad happens on day 30 in the morning in Yerushalayim, before midday, that means that That means that there's some place that is 18 hours ahead. Let me clarify this point. If the molad, the Gemara is telling us that if molad happens at Chatzos, Chatzos is, of the 30th day, is 18 hours, there are 12 hours of night and 6 hours of day, 18 hours after the earliest Shkia. So if Chatzos, if the molad was before Chatzos in Yerushalayim, that means that 18 hours ago, there was a place in the world, that means that there was a place in the world 18 hours ago that already had a Shkia. And therefore, there was a Shkia, and third day 30 is entirely in the post-Molad zone, and therefore it could be Rosh Chodesh. If, however, in Yerushalayim, the Molad occurs after Chatzos, that means that if you go 18 hours forward, 18 hours more towards the east, then there will not have been a Shkia that was before the Molad. And therefore, day 30, again, not in Yerushalayim, but in the earliest place in the world, was not after the Molad, and therefore day 30 cannot be Rosh Chodesh. Okay, that's a little bit of a difficult cheshbon. We'll continue. Now, the Chazon Ish says that, according to this, the 90 degrees east of Yerushalayim is going to be the dateline. If you're on one side of it, then it will be a day earlier. If you're on the other side of the dateline, it'll be a different day. It'll be a different day. The problem is the civil dateline is not exactly 90 degrees east of Yerushalayim. It's rather 180 degrees east of Greenwich, England. So if you're between the two lines, you're a little bit in trouble because the Chazon Ish will say, the Balmor and the Chazon Ish will say that it's already Sunday, but the world will say, the people in the world will say, it's still Saturday. And those kinds of places are places like Japan and New Zealand, and everyone is going to, I'm sorry, the opposite. We hold that it's going to be Sunday, it's on the other side of the dateline, and they hold it's not yet up to the dateline, and they'll call it Saturday. So when you get to the dateline, theoretically, one side of the dateline will be 9 o'clock on Shabbos morning, and to the right of the line will be 9:01 Sunday morning. There's a question that's raised, one of the Talmidim of the Rush, the Sefer Yesod Olam, asks in the Baal Amar, how could you have two people on two sides of the line talking to each other? For one of them it's going to be Shabbos, and for the other one it's going to be Sunday. That's sort of absurd. How could you just walk a few steps to the east out of Shabbos, and then walk back a few steps to the west into Shabbos? In other words, the way the post can see this question of this Sefer Yisrael, and they're saying, how could you have a line cross through a landmass? So some say, I mean, it is what it is. It's a difficult idea, but it is what it is, and that's the halacha, it cuts through a landmass. But others, like the Chazon Ish, did like this svara, this challenge of the Yisrael Olam, and therefore said that even though we hold where the dateline is should be 90 degrees east of Yerushalayim, but instead of cutting through landmass, we'll sort of draw it along the perimeter of the land at the right after the 90 degrees. You go to the end of that landmass, and then you'll draw a line along the perimeter of that landmass, along the edge, the beach of that landmass. So now, you're not going to slice Australia and China in the middle, as Baal Hamara's line might directly indicate, but rather we'll assume all of China and all of Australia will be on our side of the line, and have the same day of Shabbos as New York and of Israel. But anything past the edge of the beach of China and Australia will taka be the next day. So Japan, unfortunately, will indeed be on the other side. They're not connected. Japan's not connected to China. So it will be cut away from Asia, and it will be Shabbos will be on Sunday in Japan, according to the Chazon Ish and the Baal HaMa'ar. Now, Rav Tukhachinsky disagrees with what we said, and he says that the Chazon Ish assumed, the Baal Amar, the Chazon Ish assumed that the dateline is 90 degrees east of Yerushalayim. Rav Tukhachinsky assumed the dateline is 180 degrees east of Yerushalayim. Now again, the differences are minimal because it's mostly Pacific Ocean between 90 and 180 degrees between these two opinions, but the machlokas between them will come out with Hawaii will be a nafkamina between them. And the machlokas is based on the, how they understand the pasuk in Yecheskel that says that Eretz Yisrael is tabur ha'aretz, the belly button of the land, is like the Radak understands the middle of the land. So according to Kuczynski, Eretz Yisrael is the middle of the land. So if Eretz Yisrael is the middle of the world, so the dateline has to be 180 degrees from Eretz Yisrael. But Chazanish said, no, 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 we don't look at the whole world as the whole world. Our world is viewed only as Asia Europe, Eurasia, which is where, you know, humanity was for most of history. And therefore, since Israel is in the middle of Asia and Europe, that's what the Chazal is saying, that we're in the middle of Asia Europe, not of the world itself. Of course, when it came to Yom Kippur in the Mir Yeshiva in Shanghai, the official policy was to follow the Chazon Ish, and Shabbos was on Sunday, but the Rabban Yerushalayim assumed that it was on Shabbos. Now, there's one other opinion, and that is what they call the poskim who assume it's the mid-Pacific, that they go to the end of Asia, which is the sort of the very top part of Siberia, where Siberia almost touches Alaska, and right there's the Bering Straits in between Alaska and Siberia. At that point, instead of hugging the coast of Asia, instead of doing that, they sort of just draw a line straight down south, and that's how you would figure out where the line would be. Let's just talk about a halacha, a nafkamina or two, and that would be, if you're traveling from Japan to New York, and you daven, let's say you're in Monday in Japan, and you davened in Japan on Monday. You fly out, and it becomes Monday night, and by the time you land in New York, you traveled over the dateline, and it's now Monday morning. But wait a second, you davened on Monday already. You davened with Shachar and Mincha on Monday already. Now you get landing in New York, it's Monday morning again. So here we have machlokas. Some say you should daven again. Some say, no, you did your davening already. You daven Monday, you don't have to daven again. Okay, that will be enough for this shiur on the dateline. Let's now go to the next shiur, which is the halachas of mikvos from Rabbi Sabalovsky. Okay, so there is a psil, of course, of shu'uvim, and any water that is in a receptacle is considered shu'uvim. Machlokas is drabon or daraisa. So on one hand, it might be gzeira atu tvila bekli, which is pasul daraisa, and others say that it's asu daraisa. But even if you hold that shu'uvim is daraisa, it might only be if it's rov shu'uvim. But if it's miat shu'uvim, that might only be darabonon. Indeed, the Rama is machmir and holds that rov shuvin is indeed plumbing is indeed pasul daraisa. Fine. Now, pipes could be an issue. Why? Because pipes, if there are any kinks in the pipe or bends in the pipe or angles to the pipe, that itself could be a collection of water. So therefore, you have to have pipes that are totally straight. But wait, what about the fact that if there's a pipe that's kavua, even though a pipe is not a kli, but if there's a flat pipe that has a hole or a nick in it, does that make consider it a base kibble? Well, most rishonim matter because we're not made l'shem base kibble, but some, like the Mordechai, say the base kibble would be a problem even if it wasn't made to be a base kibble. So therefore, we don't use wood that could have these little indentations and they could rot. Rather, we use plastic pipes that are neither mekabel tuma nor they get any rotting. That would be the best pipes to use. So the problem that we have to really deal with, and this is the main lumdus in mikvahs, is how do you take care of dirty water? So there are two or three ways, and two main ways. And that is, number one, hashaka. Hashaka means connecting a bor tevila to the bor that has the mei geshamim. And the hole between them has to be at least a shoferes hanod. And you never dip in the mei geshamim, you come into the mei tevila, and the mei tevila has a hole that it's connecting to the mei geshamim. And if that hole is open, so then you are connected, like there's that electrical flow between you, where you are, and where the original kosher water is. So the question will be, does the hole have to actually be open while you are being tovel, or is it sufficient that once the hole is open, then all the water in the bor tevila, it was hukshar, and then you could close it up. What that will allow us to do is, to drain, to use the mei tvi, the bor tvila, use it and gets dirty and drain it. And then just after you refill it, just open up for a moment with the mei geshamim and then close it, and then you're good to go and recycle the cycle again. So most poskim, most of the rishonim assume that as long as the water touched one time, it's huksha forever, and you could really have a very clean mikvah by letting the waters touch for a moment and then closing the hole and having the tefillahs only in a bor tefillah that you'll use until it gets dirty, and then you'll empty it and refill it and open up the seal again for a moment. That would be great. The problem is there's a Rabbeinu Yeruchim. The Rabbeinu Yeruchim says that the hole has to be open during the tefillah. He feels that it has to be open during the tefillah. Now, we try to be machmir for that Rabbeinu Yeruchim, even though it's a miut in the Rishonim, and if you do that, then we have a problem that the dirty water from the base tevila is going to start displacing the water of the Mei Geshamim, and you're going to have, you're going to have dirty water in the Bar Geshamim. Another problem might be is that you're going to have an attendant might forget to open the hole during the tevila, which is not so terrible, but according to Rabbeinu Yeruchim is bad. But furthermore, the worst thing will be that if you refill the base tefila, a problem in general, I'm sorry, with Hashaka is, there's just a general critique of Hashaka, is that if you refill the base tefila, the bar tefila, and then you forget to reconnect it, so then it's mamish kula she'uvim, which is going to be puzzle daraisa according to the Rama. So there's another kind of bar, and that is a bar zriya. Bar zriya, instead of having a hole between two boros, so what you do is you pour, you have one kosher mei geshamim bar, and you pour right on top of it tap water into it. And as it, you plant the water from the tap into the bar geshamim, and it flows over into an adjacent bar tevila. Goes through the bar geshamim and fills up thereby a bar tevila. And therefore, all the water in the bar tevila is kosher water. You don't have to worry about keeping a hole open or about remembering to open a hole, but it has a problem. The problem is that as you do this a number of times, at some point you are going to have only tap water, or the vast majority will be tap water, and there'll be almost no mei geshamim left because you have been pouring, there's been displacement. So most Rishonim are not bothered because they assume that the psil of Nasan Sa and Natal Sa is only applicable to liquids like juices, but there is a Ravid who says that you always have to have Rov Mei Geshamim, and the Issa of Nasan Sav and Natal Sav applies even to Mayim Shuvin. So according to that, we're going to be in trouble. So Chasam Sofer wasn't worried about that Ravid, we don't pass like it, and the Chazon Ish was not worried about it. But what we do is to satisfy both the concern for the Rabbeinu Yeruchim and the concern for the Ravid is we have a hybrid of a Tvila in the middle, that's flanked with two boros. One is a bar geshamim, one is a bar zriya. And then we pour the tap water only into the bar zriya, and it overflows into the base tefila. And the bar hashaka, we open and allow that water to stay where there is. Now, there is a problem that the Chazon Ish is concerned with the bar hashaka, and that is, even if you have a bor hashaka, it's not going to keep its own water. Forget that bor zriya, which certainly won't. But even the bor hashaka, there will be a flow, a displacement of water. And by having a bor hashaka stagnant for 2 times, it's going to become infested with bacteria, which will ultimately creep their way into the base tefila, which is a problem. So what people suggested to alleviate the Chazon Ish's concern is to have a split-level bor hashaka, one on top of the other, with a shofar sanor between them, and 40 sa in each. And the bottom bor will not really lose its displacement because the water on top is pushing down the water on the bottom, and the water on the bottom is colder, so it will stay where it is. And the water on the bottom will stay clean and stay bor mei geshamim. And this way, you have all the boros connected to each other. The Chabad has a bor al gabe bor. There really can't be a human error because you just have a bor sitting on top of bor tefillah on top of bor geshamim. The problem is that the Divrei Chaim says that this vertical hashaka doesn't work because there's a psul called katafis in a chibur, a vertical connection is not a chibur, and therefore according to the Divrei Chaim, that solution would not be okay. But that is another issue of discussion. We'll stop with this. Let's go now to talk a little bit about Machios Chametz, and we'll finish with that. One second, please. So, Mechiras Chametz is a Mefurisha. Mechiras Chametz is a Mefurisha to Sefta, that you could sell your Chametz to a guy and buy it back. As the Tosefta says, Ovilvad Shelo Ye Yarim. The question is, what does that mean? So, does it mean that you don't buy it back next year? That's what the Bahag says. That means you can't buy it back afterwards. I mean, sorry, you could buy it back afterwards, the Tosefta says, but you can't do this year after year. That's what the Bahag says. And other Rishonim say, no, it just means Vavachal Yarim means it's a real bona fide sale without any tanais. You're selling it without tanai, no conditions, but you are permitted to buy it back after Pesach if you want. Now, in order to sell the chametz, the Truma Sedeshin says that it has to be, not enough to sell, but it has to be sold outside your bias. So how could I sell it outside my bias? So I could either give it to the guy and he'll take it home, or if I'm going to do it with a community where I can't have the guy lift up all the churu boxes from 400 houses in the neighborhood, so I could rent that place where the chametz is located to the guy, so it's considered in the guy's bias. Now, that will also accomplish another point, because it will help me transfer the chametz to him through the kinyan by him having that ownership of that land, but we'll talk about that in a moment. The issue of mechiras chametz being a challenge really started in the time of the Bach, 1600s, that was when Jews got into the schnapps business and we couldn't just hand it over to the guy. But the Bach in those discussions does talk about the necessity to give the guy the key, because if he doesn't have the key, he's not really, he doesn't have smichus das. So nowadays, you don't need a, perhaps if you have a cell phone number, that's just as good as a key, because if the guy wants to get in, so he'll just call the cell phone number and he'll be able to get in. The main issue that we have when it comes, the challenge that we have with mechiras chametz is how to transfer the chametz to a guy. So chametz is metaltlin. So how are you makne metaltlin from a Jew to a guy? So this is the same shaila that is going to apply, as the Rishonim point out, by transferring a bechor to a guy in order to make the guy own a little bit of the bechor, so the baby won't have a kedushas bechor. So how do you do that? So there's a machlok. There's a pasuk that says "Uchisim krumim kolam misacha, konami yada misacha," that has a machlokas amoraim, whether maos konos or meshicha kona. And this pasuk is talking about a Jew, la misacha, yal tanu ishes achir. It's talking about a Jew, and therefore, whatever, if you hold that maos konos midvar Torah, that's true by a Jew, but for a guy, meshicha would be kona. Inversely, if you hold like Rish Lakish that Mashiach is Kona Midaraisa, that means for a guy, it would be Maos Konos. So, how do we paskin? Well, it's a Machlokas. According to Rashi, we paskin that Mashiach is, the Yisrael is Kona in the Talmud of Mashiach, so therefore a guy is only Bekesef. So that's very easy to do. A guy is only Bekesef, he just gives you a dollar and he buys all of your chametz. That's easy. The problem is, Tosfos says that there's another opinion. And the other opinion is that a Jew is kona b'kesef. That means a guy is kona b'mashiach. And that means the only way, that there's no such thing as a kinyan kesef by a guy. The only way a guy could acquire is if he does mashiach. And that's physically impossible. So according to that, we are not going to be able to sell our chametz to a guy via a kinyan kesef, because kesef only works for a Jew, and you need to do a mashiach, and mashiach is just physically impossible. So what the goal of the rest of the shir and the goal of the rabbis, mechiras chametz, is to figure out ways that besides taking a dollar to fulfill the opinion, the first opinion, that maybe kinyan kesef does work for metaltelin and for chametz to transfer to a guy, what else, what other kinyan could we do that will circumvent the need to do the mashiach? So let me rephrase that. In order to definitely be makne my chametz to the guy, I have to cover both bases and do both a kesef and mashicha. but practically I can't do Mashiach because of practical and circumstantial circumstances. So I have to. We're going to look for other kinyanim to take the place of the Mashiach that I wouldn't need to cover both bases. What kind of kinyanim could we suggest? Let's talk about a kinyan chatzer. So I could be makna the chatzer, where the shelf where the shirios are situated, and then if the guy owns the shelf, he could be kona that which is on top of the shelf. That's one possibility. What's the problem with that? The ketos raises the problem that chatzer might be mishum shlichus, and we know that a guy doesn't have shlichus, in which case a guy might not be subject, might not have the advantage of using a kinyan chatzer. Another suggestion is that we could use kinyan agav. Now agav means that not one, things that are on my property I could be kinyan, but agav means once you do a kinyan that's chashuv, that kinyan itself could be chal on something that's less chashuv, that's more tuffel to it. The way the Shari Yosher says is ikr and tuffel, just like if I cream cheese on a bagel, you don't make a bracha on the cream cheese because the bracha on the hamotzi covers the cream cheese. So too, the kinyan on the real estate, on the chashuv real estate, counts as the kinyan on the metaltalin, and that works even if the metaltalin are in a different location. I could give you a piece of property here, and you could be kona my metaltalin in Chicago or in Hawaii or in Nepal. Oh, so kinyan agav will allow me by being makna to the guy a little bit of land, like the cabinet underneath the Cheerios. I could also transfer to him the chametz as well because it's tafel to the karka that I'm giving him. The problem with that is that agav might only work midrabanan, and if it only works midrabanan, how could it take care of the iser daraisa of owning chametz on Pesach? That another question is, if you don't own land, how could you do kinyan agav to him? The whole point of agav is that by me, the Yisrael, be makna to him land, I could give him other stuff that is tertiary to the land. But if I don't own any land, I can't start. So here we said, the Rashba says that you don't have to actually own land, even if there's land that you have access to, or you're makna the base medrash, that's also fine. Okay, now just so you know, the Mishavura writes that the main kinyan happens to be agav. Okay. Right. And what about trying another kinyan? Let's try chalipin. Does chalipin work? Kavi makna to chalipin. Well, the problem is that the pasuk from which we learn chalipin is a pasuk in Rus, and it says zos lefanim b'Yisrael. It sounds like it's only for Kal Yisrael. So maybe there is no chalipin to a guy. Let's stop here. That will be the discussions again. Just to clarify one point, the reason why you have to do all these various kinyanim is because really you have to do Kesef and Mashiach, and since Mashiach is physically not possible, you're trying to do all other kinyanim to take the place of that. Now, there happen to be a bunch of others. We also do a kinyan Odisa, which is like you're being Moda B'fnei Bezdin. We do a Hefker Bezdin Hefker. We also do kinyan Situmta. The problem of kinyan Situmta is that it might also only be the Rabbanan, and those are the kinyanim that we do. Hatzlacha Rabba, Kol Tov.